the but get down the lungs, basically.
You need fuel. You need fuel.
Yeah, it's not enough.
It's not like, you're pulling gasoline in the tank. The heat certainly can go down.
Which, the body's not a fan of that. Yeah. With our kids, we're always, oh, teach me something new today. So, now I know something new.
Do you get home and teach them?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Hey, kids, let's do a trick. Open your mouth.
No. How? These are teenagers. I convince them to grow up to be dentists or anesthesiologists or something.
I'm ready. I hope it works out. Find out from the people that attend.
So we're having our presentation virtually then.
It moves. I don't know. I don't know if Stuart's on the line. Let me find out.
All right, we'll figure it out. All right, so we'll call the meeting to order. Anesthesia Sedation Committee meeting, and I imagine turn it over to staff for a roll call.
Yes. Goodman?
Present.
Bad Guy?
Present.
Beanstalk? She'll be late. She just texted me. Blazik?
Present.
Brady?
I'm here.
Brownstein? Christensen?
Eager and ready to participate.
Awesome. Hero?
Here.
Derman?
Here.
Lau?
Sorry.
Present.
Sorry.
And Snell?
Here.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do we happen to have anybody in the call to the public virtually? Because here in the room, it does not look like we have anybody.
What was the question? I'm sorry, Ryan.
Oh, yeah, this is Mr. Goodman. Do we have, for the call to the public portion of our committee meeting, do we have anybody on virtually or telephonically?
I am not a member of the committee, and my name is Larry Moore. I've been asked to speak on behalf of the Arizona Society.
Well, that's probably the presenter for.
Okay.
That is our, that's Dr. Moore is our presenter, but I understood there was another, were you guys having Dr. Harris also present?
Dr. Harris will be present to present, because it's a different topic, not specifically. But it's on the agenda number 7.
Okay. We'll get to the call, to the actual presentation then. Yeah.
We have someone taking minutes right now, so if everyone could first speak their name into the record before they speak, that would be a big help.
Oh, that's great. So you can do last name, Goodman, Snell, whatever it is.
And I believe the last person who spoke was Dr. Blakely.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Goodman, thank you for the comment. We'll do the best we can, and you now have permission to use my name in front of any comment, it sounds like, because that was the example that. Anything that we're going to have to strike for the record later, you should say Goodman first. That's the setup. All right. So it sounds like we don't, for the call to the public, although we do have some presentations today. So with that, if we're able to, we probably should, with respect to those that are presenting, move to those parts of the agenda. So it sounds like, which item was that we had already?
So, there's three presentations on the agenda. Originally, we had spoken yesterday.
Yeah.
And this is Ryan Andrew, by the way. We spoke yesterday, and Dr. Brady, we put it on the agenda, and then I gave him a heads up probably a little too late, and so we were going to move it to another agenda. He quickly compiled some information. I sent and printed out today with documents. I guess I'll leave it up to the committee on whether or not you want, because you haven't had the opportunity to look at the documents prior to today. But I think that Dr. Brady that can't be in attendance to the full meeting, so if he's on your committee, so you may want to let him present first and then cover the wall.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we'll go in that order if it's okay with everybody. No one's jumping up and down, so let's do start with Dr. Brady. And for each of these presentations, do we have a designated amount of time that we're expecting?
I think Dr. Brady, this is Ryan, Dr. Brady is about 10 minutes probably, and then the oral application is an association or society.
It's the American Association for Oral Maxillofacial Surgery.
Okay, is there an Arizona chapter?
Yeah, so then the Arizona Society of Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons is part of our what we call tripartite level of
society.
All right.
Just point of, this is lazy, a point of clarification. Can the people on the virtual meeting hear us?
They can.
They can, through this microphone here.
I can hear you.
Very good. Okay.
So,
Mr. Chairman?
30 minutes with presenting and questions.
Right. Okay. All right. So, Goodman, we're going to go ahead and start off with Dr. Brady's presentation then. Is that what it sounds like?
Yes.
Okay. So please go ahead, Dr. Brady, and please do share.
Hi. So thank you. I was just waiting to kind of chime in. And I really hate to ask this of the committee, but I had a laptop issue, and I have another laptop coming that'll be here in 10 minutes where I'm at.
Okay. No worries. So, yeah, we'll probably delay your presentation for what sounds like about 30 minutes as we move to the oral maxillofacial surgeon's presentation if they're prepared.
That's fine with me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Technical issues about.
Yeah, yeah.
if it's this is lazy again. If it behooves the committee, I could do just a brief introduction of Dr. Moore. I think it'd be appropriate.
Please.
Okay. So Dr. Moore is a representative of the American Association of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgeons, and has served as the president of our association, as well as he is currently our president-elect of the association. And he is here talking today at the request of Dr. Christensen and myself, as well as the Arizona Society of Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons. And he's specifically going to discuss issues related to oral surgery, anesthesia, and how it's been provided over the years, and what we feel is kind of a situation on a national level that oral surgery attempts to deliver anesthesia. So, and his credentials are certainly quite a bit longer than what I'm providing. So I just wanted to give that brief introduction as far as his background.
Thank you. And then for those virtually, this is Goodman. Dr. Christensen's here with the committee as well.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you here. So, Dr. Moore, please do share.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Larry Moore. I'm a past president, actually, of the American Association of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgeons. Although Randy wanted to make me president-elect, I'm not doing those 3 years again. I'm currently the immediate past president of the California Association of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgeons. I've also served 6 years as an examiner for the American Board of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery, and I am the principal author of the 2018 California Pediatric Anesthesia Safety Bill, SB 501, which is now part of statute, part of the law in California. Excuse me. I'm also one of two official spokespersons for the AAOMS, the American Association of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgeons, nationally. For the past 5 years, I've been deeply involved in the controversies that have washed over dentistry in the wake of an excoriating attempt in California to adjudicate the complexities of office-based sedation and anesthesia in the public free-for-all that is social media. My only purpose here is to share my experiences with you, identify perhaps mistakes I made, and suggest that a proactive approach to enhancing anesthesia safety throughout dentistry is a better approach than to engage in finger-pointing. I understand that this panel is convened because there have been 17 fairly recent adverse outcomes that have occurred in dental offices in Arizona. Unfortunately, I do not know the details of these tragic events, but I do understand the impact these events have on family, loved ones, practitioners involved. My goal is to suggest a pathway to enhance anesthesia safety for everyone in dentistry. It is indeed an honor to be allowed to address you today, and I want to thank the Arizona Society, OMS, for its help in giving me this opportunity. I've been involved in the leadership of OMS for over 30 years. No issue is more important to OMS and to dentistry as a whole than the use of safe, effective, affordable office-based sedation and anesthesia. Dentistry has historically named levels of sedation based not only on the level of sedation achieved, but on the route of administration of the drugs. For example, oral sedation versus parenteral, conscious sedation versus general anesthesia. For simplicity and to embrace the wave of the future in terms of terminology, I'd like to use the updated terminology that's used by the AAOMS and was created by the American Society of Anesthesiologists based on the level of sedation, regardless of the route of administration. Excuse me. These levels are minimal sedation, moderate sedation, deep sedation, and general anesthesia. I won't belabor that because I know this committee is well-versed in these issues. In California, permits from the dental board are required to administer moderate sedation, deep sedation, and general anesthesia to any patient. And also, permits are required for minimal sedation to children under the age of 13. The use of procedural sedation administered by the doctor doing the procedure is not limited to dentistry. Emergency room physicians, gastroenterologists, cardiologists, interventional radiologists all frequently use procedural sedation for anxiety and pain management during painful procedures without employing an anesthesiologist or CRNA. By far, the most frequent use of deep sedation in general anesthesia and dentistry is by oral and maxillofacial surgeons, both in the U.S. and in Canada. This practice model has been called the single operator model. But that term is a misnomer. The appropriate term is the OMS team anesthesia delivery model, which employs teams of a minimum of three individuals. One, the highly trained surgeon anesthesiologist. OMSs receive 5 months of full-time anesthesia training on the anesthesia service, as well as 30 months of cumulative experience during their residencies of 4 to 6 years in safe delivery of outpatient anesthesia. Number two in that team is a well-trained staff person whose sole responsibility it is to monitor the patient. And three, a surgical assistant, also trained in BLS. It takes a team to deliver safe office-based anesthesia and procedural sedation. Over 4 million sedation procedures are safely done this way by the 9,000 members of the AAOMS every year. This accounts for more than 90% of total sedation procedures done in dentistry. The OMS team anesthesia delivery model has been in widespread use for over 70 years, and it is clearly the safest model available, providing cost-effective, accessible procedural sedation care for children and adults undergoing painful dental procedures of short duration in the OMS office setting. 50 years ago in Southern California, one of the societies that later became CalAMIS, a adopted a proactive, mandatory culture of safety for anesthesia for its members. In or about 1970, the Southern California Society of OMS mandated the use of a cardiac monitor, a pretracheal stethoscope, as well as non-invasive blood pressure, pulse, and respiration monitoring for deep sedation, general anesthesia. They made compliance with these safety measures a requirement for membership. By 1974, they had established a mandatory office safety inspection program by a committee of experienced OMSs, both as an initial requirement for membership and every 5 years thereafter, maintain membership. At the same time, they established a training program for OMS anesthesia called OMSA, O-M-S-A-A, Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery Anesthesia Assistant Program. The OMSA program is still in widespread use in California, and the AAOMS, our national association, has developed a similar program that is available as distance learning called the DANCE, D-A-A-N-C-E, which stands for Dental Anesthesia Assistant National Certifying Examination. AMOS also eventually followed California in adopting a mandatory periodic anesthesia safety office inspection to obtain and maintain membership in the association. By 1984, the state of California had adopted into law the exact Southern California Society Office Inspection Program and had contracted with the Southern California Society and the Northern California Society to administer it for the dental board. Later, these two societies would merge, creating one state society, CalAMIS. Over the years, whenever new technology became available to make sedation and general anesthesia safer, CalAMIS and AMIS were early adopters and quick to mandate the use of technology such as pulse oximetry and capnography. Both organizations have been consistently 5 to 10 years ahead of any state's statute in mandating an ever-evolving culture of safety and anesthesia for dentistry. The culture of safety demands we try to reach zero morbidity and mortality in the delivery of office-based anesthesia. One important way to assure anesthesia safety is the team model. But a team has to practice. So AMIS now mandates frequent team emergency drills in the office and continuing education for doctors and staff. Oftentimes, doctors and staff working together in emergency education situations. Once again, ahead of the curve, AMIS endorses the use of high-fidelity simulation to hone the skills of anesthesia teams. God forbid the first time an anesthesia assistant, for that matter, an OMS or a dentist, should see their first experience of an anesthetic emergency in a real patient. Far better to see it in a high-fidelity model. A state-of-the-art facility capable of training groups of up to 100 was completed this year at AMIS headquarters in Rosemont, Illinois, which is conveniently close to O'Hare Airport for fly-in weekend seminars. We as dentists have been, for the past 5 years, under a sustained and calculated attack by medical and dental specialty groups bent upon limiting our ability to provide digitalization. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry issued guidelines in 2016 for the management of pediatric patients undergoing procedural sedation. This document, authored by Charles Cote and others, is an excellent resource for any dentist performing office-based pediatric minimal, moderate, or deep sedation in general anesthesia. The OMS anesthesia team was consistent with the recommendations of the 2016 document. Our independent anesthesia monitor was and is a dental assistant, ideally trained with a minimum of 6 to 12 months of on-the-job training, including OMSA or dance training, provided either by CalAMIS or AMIS. Unfortunately, the AAP, AAPD guidelines were politicized in its 2019 revision, attacking the OMS team model, and in the 2019 update, the following statement was added. The independent observer in the dental facility, as permitted by state regulation, must be one of the following: a physician anesthesiologist, a certified registered nurse anesthetist, a second oral surgeon, or a dentist anesthesiologist. The mandate that two OMSs would be necessary for deep sedation and general anesthesia for pediatric cases would have effectively reduced the dental anesthesia workforce in California by nearly half, precipitating a crisis in access to care for children in California, where 50% of children under 18 are on the DentiCal program, the government-subsidized sort of minimal access program. The 2019 guidelines were also promoted as being applicable not only to the AAP and the AAPD, but to all physicians and dentists regarding treatment of children. Traditionally, every dental and medical specialty has its own guidelines or parameters of care that apply to its own members. This was an unprecedented move on the part of the AAP, AAPD. There was an effort to have the guidelines entered into statute in California. I almost supported this idea during my work on SB501, but after observing testimony given by Dr. Cote, California Assembly Hearing Room, in 2017, I realized the language could and likely would be changed after the fact and still be part of California law. So the AAP, AAPD guidelines were never incorporated into the 2018 bill, Senate Bill 501. In 2019, the ASA and the American Society of Dentists and Anesthesiologists, ASDA, a group of dentists, about 300, I believe, in the U.S. and Canada with significant training in anesthesiology, joined this group. This group joined in supporting 2019 guidelines, thereby singling out OMS and alleging that our team anesthesia model is dangerous. Remember, the guidelines were changed without any additional information being considered immediately after the passage of Senate Bill 501 in California. Choosing not to include a document which is malleable or changeable by an outside organization in a statute or regulation is a very good policy for any state. Perhaps more importantly, these guidelines are not evidence-based, but rather the document is based on the consensus opinions of the joint AAP committees. Consensus opinions are considered the weakest form of information in a scientific sense, and the political content of this document certainly has no evidence base. My conclusion, based on 5 years of digging deeply into this issue, is that some of the principals were misinformed and misled by individuals who stood to benefit from the sudden loss of OMS's anesthesia scope of practice during the legislative battles precipitated in California by the death of a six-year-old in an OMS office near San Francisco. Stories of dozens of deaths occurring in OMS offices were circulated in social media platforms where they harmed the interests of the grieving family and made it difficult to speak the truth. In response to the tragic death of six-year-old Caleb Sear in 2015 in an OMS office in the San Francisco Bay Area, the California Association of OMS, CalAMS, created a task force of member oral and maxillofacial surgeons skilled in anesthesia delivery to children to investigate the incident. The task force was also instructed to conduct a critical review of practices and outcomes for all children undergoing procedural sedation in OMS offices in California. The task force discovered through member surveys, review of closed claims insurance documents, Dental Board of California records, and historical media reports that this had been the only death of a pediatric patient under 13 years of age in an OMS office in over 17 years. In response to AB 2235, also called Caleb's Law, the Dental Board of California in 2015 and 2016 conducted a comprehensive study to review pediatric dental anesthesia practices in the United States and conducted an analysis of its own records on pediatric morbidity and mortality. I provided a copy of this report for all of you because this was done with great thoroughness and honesty. The 6 years of Dental Board of California data on pediatric mortality from January 1, and by the way, this report also includes morbidity, but I'm focusing only on the mortality. It revealed that there had been, in the period January 1, 2010 to December 31, 2015, 9 deaths associated with dental treatment in the state. 8 were anesthesia-related in that time period. From January 1, 2016, in other words, immediately following the Dental Board's report, until December 31st, 2019, 3 more pediatric deaths have been reported in children under the age of 7 in California. Of the 12 total cases, 11 were anesthesia-related. 3 of the deaths were from oral conscious sedation administered in pediatric dental offices by pediatric dentists. 2 were from local anesthetic overdose by general dentist. 5 were from deep sedation general anesthesia administered by dedicated separate anesthesia provider, either MD or DDS anesthesiologist. 1 was the case I mentioned of the tragic death of Caleb Sears in an OMS office. The DBC enforcement arm investigation into this case resulted in revocation of the OMS's permit to administer sedation and deep sedation and general anesthesia, indicating a finding of practice outside the standard of care. The DBC pediatric anesthesia study, published in December 2016, found that the dental pediatric anesthesia practices in California were comparable or superior to those in place throughout the United States. The anesthesia subcommittee of the DBC recommended the following. The board recommends updating terminology, in other words, changing what has become archaic terminology used in dentistry, such as oral conscious sedation, to those terms used by the ASA and by AMIS and by OMS in general. They also recommended changing staffing requirements, educational requirements, and monitoring standards in an effort to improve the safety of pediatric dental anesthesia and sedation. That can be found in the DBC report, which the Arizona Society will make available to you if you don't already have it. Based on the findings of the CalAMIS Task Force and the conclusions of the Dental Board of California report, pediatric anesthesia study in December 2016, CalAMIS sponsored and introduced Senate Bill 501, Glazer, 2017, legislation that was signed into law on September 29, 2018, by then-Governor Jerry Brown. This landmark pediatric anesthesia safety bill addresses all the concerns expressed by the DBC Anesthesia Subcommittee, including updating terminology, enhancing education, training, and staffing requirements for both doctors and staff, and the use of capnography. These changes by 2022 will apply to everyone who gives anesthesia in a dental office, whether an oral surgeon, an MD anesthesiologist with a dental board permit, or a dentist anesthesiologist. These changes apply to children under 13, and even stricter requirements for children under 7. The California legislature overwhelmingly decided to support the evidence rather than follow the emotion and politics surrounding anesthesia care for children in dentistry. SB 501 essentially mandates the OMS team anesthesia model for all providers of sedation to children in dental offices in California. The intent of SB 501 was to make pediatric anesthesia in the dental office safer for everyone, OMS, everyone. We are all dentists, and the public does not understand the nuances of dental specialty or care what kind of dentist is responsible when a tragic outcome occurs in a dental office. If you're planning to do a study in Arizona similar to the one performed by the Dental Board of California, I would recommend the data points include age of the patient, and any significant medical history, special needs, systemic illness, birth, or chromosomal abnormalities. Anesthesia provider type, general dentist, pediatric dentist, CRNA, MD, or DDS anesthesiologist, or OMS. It should be determined whether the anesthesia provider was involved in the dental care or was the anesthesia provider performing only that service. Was the anesthesia provider working in his or her own office or was that person itinerant? What was the procedure and the duration of the procedure? What type of anesthesia was intended and what type was actually given? What were the drugs and doses in a time-based format for the case? What were all the monitors being used? Who were the personnel involved and the qualifications of the personnel? Where was the site where the treatment was done? An OMS office, a surgery center, pediatric dental office, general dental office, community dental clinic, etc. Where was the site where the death or serious injury occurred? In the procedure room, in the recovery room, in the parent's car or home, somewhere else? What personnel, if any, were present when and if emergency medical services were activated? The more detailed the data points, the better the information becomes. Of course, de-identified, completely de-identified information, but the more detailed this information is, the better it can be used for education and prevention of future tragic events. I humbly recommend that you adopt a culture of safety in Arizona and take proactive steps to institute changes that have already been proven to make a difference. For example, the mandatory use of capnography in all moderate sedations, deep sedations, and general anesthetics has been proven by the ASA to save lives and prevent death and permanent morbidity such as anoxic brain damage. The OMS team model of anesthesia delivery has the best safety record in dentistry. In moderate sedation, deep sedation, and general anesthesia, the presence of one individual whose only responsibility is to monitor the patient and maintain a patent airway during surgery or dental treatment has given OMS its enviable safety record. And minimum training for that individual should include basic emergency airway management and specific training in pediatric emergency airway management, such as PALS, if treating children under 7. This assistant does not need to have an advanced degree, and it is, in my opinion, elitist and arrogant to assume a well-trained high school graduate could not safely do this job. The American Heart Association believes correctly that bystander BLS saves lives in sudden cardiac death and stroke when given by BLS-trained high school graduates and even students. The same can be said for anesthesia assistants in dentistry. It's not the initials that come after their name, it's the training they get. It takes a team, even when the anesthesiologist is not also involved in doing the surgery. If the dentist or dental surgeon is not an OMS, that person may not be trained at all in rescuing patients, especially children, from sedation, especially deep sedation and general anesthesia. The anesthesiologist needs a dedicated assistant who is both well-trained and experienced in monitoring and in anesthesia assisting. A life-saving code blue cannot be run and done by one person. It takes a team. Most of the deaths in the California DBC study occurred in the recovery room, tragically. And tragically could have been prevented if the dental staff watching the child had basic onset or dance level training coupled with basic emergency airway training. I urge you to mandate training for the recovery room staff and dental offices where deep sedation anesthesia are done, regardless of who does the deep sedation and general anesthesia. Establish criteria for safe discharge of patients, especially pediatric patients. 7. This is clearly the area where the greatest risk occurs. This was also held up by the Blue Ribbon Panel in Texas, where similar findings to what I'm telling you for California were found. the Dental Board of California Pediatric Anesthesia Safety Study 2016 and the 2016 AAPD guidelines are attached for your reference. The text of SB 501, 2018, is also provided for your convenience, and the final draft of this presentation will be made available on request of the Arizona Society. Please, let's keep compassionate management of pain, fear, and anxiety firmly in the armamentarium of dentistry by making it as safe as humanly possible. I wish you Godspeed and success on your mission. Thank you very much.
Goodman speaking here. Thank you, Dr. Moore. Appreciate that. So we'll, if you're willing and able, we'll turn the time over to the committee for some questions for you.
Absolutely.
Please go ahead, Dr. German.
This is Dr. German. Dr. Moore, thank you very much for presenting to us. We appreciate it and appreciate your time. A couple of questions. The dance assistant, just so I understand correctly, as you said, could be a high school graduate with ideally 6 to 12 months of on-the-job training, but not necessary. Is that correct?
The requirements for enrolling a staff person in the dance or in OMSA, which is precursor, are that they have at least 6 months on-the-job training before they begin the training. The training takes about 3 to 6 months.
And the training is only online?
The dance training is only online. OMSA training is augmented by a weekend in-person training session, and there are courses in medical emergency management for the team that these candidates are encouraged to take also that are provided by Cal Amos. The dance is an entirely distant learning process.
Gotcha. And what exactly is the role of the dance assistant during an anesthetic? And if a code were to occur, what would be their role?
All of them are at a minimum BLS trained. It's becoming more and more frequent for OMSs to take their assistants to ACLS training courses as well. What their job is as the monitor is to watch the monitors and report to the doctor, the operating surgeon, any changes of significance. They're also usually tasked with holding the head of the patient in a position where the airway remains open, and they may be using a pre-tracheal stethoscope, or there may be a Bluetooth device where everyone in the room can hear the breath sound. It varies from office to office. But generally, their responsibility is to make sure the patient is breathing and to report any changes in the monitors that the doctor may not have noticed. In a code, generally, I speak for my own office staff, the person at the head would handle the bag valve mask ventilation. And this is a skill that is taught in the Cal Amos Medical Emergencies courses, which are available on an annual basis.
So just so I understand, so the surgeon relies on the judgment of this individual to interpret what a significant change in monitoring may be?
Yes, they're taught to understand what the parameters of normal are and to report any deviation. They're not doing any analysis. They're just reading the numbers on the monitor, and they understand what the numbers mean based on their dance training.
Okay. But if I could we comment? This is Blazing. Can we comment during the discussion? Also, I think one thing that I have 5 dance trained anesthesia assistants in my office, and for example, today we did 6 general anesthetics, and they listen to that airway every single day. They have profound ability to listen with a pre-tracheal stethoscope as well as to watch the patient's chest rise and fall, not just because they did the course, but it's because they do it every single day. And today was not an outlier. That's kind of our role. With these anesthesia assistants, every day they're exposed to monitoring airway, to monitoring the monitors, to understanding how to draw medication. Those aren't exactly part of the dance course, but that's what happens in an oral surgery office where every day they understand if there's an emergency,
where do we go get the emergency equipment, because we have our own crash cart, as opposed to if a banana sec is done by an outside provider and comes into an office one time a month or two times a month, no one else in that office understands how to run a code or how to run an emergency. So what
happened? Walk me through a code. So I assume that you're the one at the head of the bed managing the airway, correct? I can't assume that they're the ones managing the airway if there's an airway issue. I assume the oral surgery.
So if you're asking me, are they monitoring the airway? Absolutely. If there became a necessary airway intervention, then yes, we would do that.
So if you're doing that, and let's say the child breathes down due to hypoxia, needs a dose of epinephrine or atropine, who draws that up? Who gives that medication?
Yeah, our assistants are trained to do that. We train them ourselves.
And they're allowed to do that?
Yeah. I don't know. I Dr. Moore, you can comment on that too, but yes, I think they are. Under our trained eye, where we have helped them develop the skills to do that, and we would oversee the overall management of the code, yes.
And if an eye gets lost, do they start IVs as well?
That's not part of the dance training, but again, in my office, four of the assistants have gone through phlebotomy courses as well as IV courses. That's not mandated by our association or by the state. It's not in our statutes. But yes, I have four of the people in the office besides myself that can start IVs, and they do it every day.
But give
we'll just comment that it varies state by state what the scope of practice of an anesthesia assistant is. In California, we have a separate category called the dental sedation assistant, which is a licensed position. And the scope of practice of those assistants is greater than the OMSA assistant in California.
If I may, this is Goodman. What is the 6 months of on-site experience prior to going for the training or doing the online training?
In my experience, it is mostly involved in doing surgical assisting. Most of our employees are dental assistants who've done about 6 months of training in getting familiar with dentistry and learning how to be an assistant in a dental environment. They're trained in OSHA standard sterilization and that sort of thing, as well as the dental assisting. So when they come to us, they generally have a radiation safety permit, and they have about 6 months experience working in the dental environment. The 6 months in the OMS office is usually spent assisting. The assistant is part of that three-person team.
They
see how it's done, and toward the end of that time frame, they might even be asked to be a monitor, but they're not really qualified to do it until after they've completed the exam.
Okay, so in theory, this is part of the screening over that 6 months to make sure it's somebody that should get the training, as well as it's an opportunity for them to be there for many cases until they're trained themselves.
Right, and to be frank, you have to weed out the people who faint at the sight of blood from the ones who don't.
Yeah, well, then I'm already weeded out before my training starts.
This is German. Is there a standardized curriculum of pre-dance or pre-OMSA training in office, or is it just varies by from office to office?
This is way. So we've done the dance course, I would say, three times over the past 10 years. It is very standardized. It's a booklet that comes through AMIS that we actually administer the educational aspect of it. The test is online, like Dr. Moore has said, but we're the ones who actually provide they give us a booklet, and each chapter goes over different aspects of in-office anesthesia, which includes pharmacodynamics and kinetics, anatomy and physiology, airway management, adjunct measures taken, and I think office emergencies. And basically, this is what we do in our office, because they're provided the booklet and they're expected to study and pass the test. Well, if you just give them the booklet, that's not going to happen. So we actually educate our staff, and we sit down once or twice a week for an hour at a time, and we go through it chapter by chapter, making sure that they understand the nuances. So I'd say it is standardized in that aspect. But the individual providing lecture, Dr. Christensen, might do it differently than me.
but I don't know if there's any mandate about that, but there is a standardized booklet.
And if it, this is Goodman, once the person receives the certification, it's portable. They can move to another oral surgeon's office, another dental office.
And there's a recertification every 5 years, also, to maintain it.
Okay.
Yes, we intentionally made it portable, and we opened it up actually a few years ago to doctors who are not oral and maxillofacial surgeons. The dance is open, and so is the OMSA training course in California is open to non-oral surgery employees because we believe that it spreads the safety factor when we do that.
Thank you. Dr. Derman, did you have
more? Yeah, Dr. Moore, just one last question. Sorry, I appreciate your time. I understand the oral maxillofacial surgery group has kind of led the way with quality data registry and collection. I'm curious, I know you have the OMS QOR, the Quality Outcomes Registry. I'm curious if there have been any publications from this registry or if there's access to the outcomes data through that registry.
I am not well informed on the OMS score, so I would have to defer that question. But I could promise to get back to you. I could get an answer for you.
Okay. Dr. Moore, this is Dr. Snell. I appreciate your time, and I just want to say for the record, thank you for showing the safety that's happened with office-based anesthesia in the dental world, and I think you're the California numbers align very well with the Blue Ribbon panel that you talked about from Texas, two of the biggest states in our country that provide tons of anesthesia, and both show that dental office-based anesthesia has been very safe. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Alex Guy. I just had a couple of clarifying questions. Dr. Moore, thank you again for all that you've done for the anesthesia community. I heard a couple of the terms, anesthesia assistants. I just wanted to, these are dental assistants, right? Is there any sort of licensure for an anesthesia assistant in the dental office, or once they become GANT certified, are they then called anesthesia assistants?
I don't think I understood the question.
Well, there was a mention of scope of practice, and this isn't necessarily for you, Dr. Moore. You mentioned scope of practice for anesthesia assistants in the dental office. I mean, is that routinely?
Well, yeah, in California, for example, everything that's done, it's a state where your license as a dentist, your permit to do general anesthesia, and all other permits and licenses in dentistry are conditional. If they are not specifically called out in statute, then you can't do it. So when I said the scope of practice, it's defined in statute in California clearly exactly what a dental assistant can do, a registered dental assistant, a registered dental hygienist, an OMSA qualified assistant is considered to be a dental assistant. So their scope of practice falls under that category. The dental sedation assistant is a new category with a broader scope of practice. It's more training, and it includes the ability to drop drugs under the direct supervision of the operating surgeon and to administer those drugs to a patient already existing IV line. Those are new privileges. It also qualifies them to recover patients in any setting, general anesthesia, deep sedation, moderate sedation,
but if they don't have that advanced training, they can still draw drugs.
So I think all these, this is LASIK.
I'm more thinking about Arizona.
Thinking about Arizona. There is nothing in the statutes in the state of Arizona that defines that, no.
Okay, it's just the dental assistant. Okay.
Yeah.
So to clarify, that would mean that under the license of the surgeon, the dentist, direction could be given and then followed.
Well, there's no statute on
yeah.
it, and there's no law, but that's what happens.
Yeah, so it's at your order.
Correct.
Okay.
And I think in a broader scheme, that's what Dr. Moore is addressing, and that would be kind of like, I guess one of my questions for Dr. Moore was, you know, early in your talk, you had mentioned something about about choosing a document that cannot be changed in terms of a, was that in terms of a statute, a bill, or were you referencing just the paper that was written? Because I think as a committee, one of the things that we think about, or I do as far as state anesthesia, is this take place at a statute level, or was California forced to actually write a bill? And what were the factors that led the Dental Board of California to even get involved in this? Because I think speaking for everyone in this room, the first time we met, we had no idea there was an issue in this state.
The Dental Board of California got involved because of Assembly Bill 2235, which was passed in 2015. It mandated that the Dental Board do a comprehensive study of pediatric anesthesia practices and safety in California. The Dental Board of California created a subcommittee that conducted the examination or the inquiry, and they decided to take a look at practices throughout the country, just to compare what California did with what everybody else did. So it would be very edifying, I think, for this committee to read that report. It's an excellent report. The morbidity part of it is not in the report that was published, but it can be accessed. And if you'd like to see that, I can try to give you links where you can find that information. But the report itself deals strictly with mortality, not morbidity. The Dental Board did a really good job because of Caleb's Law. Caleb's Law was AB 2235. And as soon as that report was published, another Assembly Bill, 224, was brought forward that would have immediately suspended the ability of oral and maxillofacial surgeons to practice our model. We would have had to have had two OMSs for every case, and it would have created just a disaster in access to care in the state. Since of the 800 or so anesthesia permits in the state, about 700 of them are OMS permits. And most of our members, even though group practices are getting more popular, most of our members are still private practitioners. So it would have been a terrible thing. Then Cal Amos, having reviewed the data and seen that there really was no issue, decided to create an opposing bill, which was SB 501. And in the legislature, in a very emotional battle between the two interests, the legislature realized that we were presenting the true pathway to safety and adopted our model.
This is Wade again. Did the Dental Board conduct a study on their own, but for example, they access to care? How was that? Was that determined actually? Like was there an organization in California that looked at access to care?
There was, yes, but part of SB 501 is a formal study of the impact that the original AB 224 would have had on access to care. That is yet to be done. SB 501 will take full effect on January 1, 2022, and it includes a lot of changes that the Dental Board is working with right now, including that study. A study was done by a consumer watchdog committee of the California Department of Public Health. That group looked at the issue and issued a report that said there would definitely be a crisis in access to care, and that training people to adapt to the changes that were proposed in AB 224 would take 8 or 10 years just to get enough people to make up for the difference.
And then my last question, I'm sorry, Dr. Moore, but related to the study done in California, when you gave some of the identifiers or important things you felt that were good to look at in terms of the adverse occurrences in the state, would you make any suggestions that, let's say a case is being reviewed and looked at to be presented as an adverse occurrence, but certain data wasn't available, would the organization doing the study in California automatically throw that case out? Or would the case still be included in terms of like saying this is an adverse occurrence in the state of California, during this time period, and we have this much on the data, but we don't know if it was in a pediatric office, an oral surgeon's office, or would they throw that case out when they did the data?
No, they don't throw it out. They keep it. Unfortunately, when all of this began in 2015, the dental board was only keeping records for 5 years. So part of SB 501 was to mandate the archiving of these kinds of records for at least 15 years. Because there's a lot to be learned from reviewing these cases. The near misses are almost as important as the terrible, tragic outcome, because that's where you find your pathway to avoid that tragic outcome. So you know, there's a lot to SB 501. I only had half an hour and didn't want to use more of my time. Welcome to you. So there are many facets to it that address almost every issue that was brought up during the controversy over how we should meet this problem and improve pediatric anesthesia safety.
Again, thank you, Dr. Moore. Any other, whether on the phone or in person, any other committee members have questions for Dr. Moore?
This is Brady. Thanks, Dr. Moore. I'm going to be presenting on and highlighting quite a bit of things that you brought up in your presentation as well, as far as reporting goes. So I appreciate your time and your lecture today.
Thank you. If there are no questions.
This is Eddie Christensen, Will and Maxwell Facial Surgery. Thank you for your time and your efforts, and it's been an honor to visit with you a few times prior to this, and thank you for all the work you've done for our specialty.
Thank you, and it's my privilege to do this. I only hope to see someday that zero morbidity and mortality be a reality for us. Because what we do, what dentists do, is good work. And if it were taken away from us, the public would suffer. I'll get off my soapbox now. If there are no other questions, I will sign out. Thank you all very much. It was an honor to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks again, Dr. Moore. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. So I think this would call now for us to move to Dr. Brady. And which agenda item is that again?
9, I believe.
This is Brian. Agenda number 1.
Okay. Let's. You got your computer issues figured out, Dr. Brady?
Yes, sir. Thank you, guys. I'm sorry to be the pain today.
No,
you guys hear me okay? I have a little bit of a delay in it. But if it's okay with everyone, I'm okay over here.
Yeah, please. Maybe it looks like we maybe should take like a 5-minute break real quick. Just people have a
sure
break, and we'll call the meeting back to order in 5 minutes and do that. Looks like everybody needs a little break. Just one couple minutes.
Sounds good to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does anyone know how the PDF, how you get the PDF like this with the, I'll call it the table of contents to the left? Is that a special,
it's a bookmark.
It's a bookmark?
Mm-hmm.
So
So, like, if I open mine on here, okay, I have it. So when I get it like this, is there a way to make it look like that?
Yeah, you'll have to download it.
Oh, so download it. Okay, mm-hmm. Okay.
And then save it to your desktop.
Okay.
And then go to your desktop. Your desktop.
Okay.
Oh,
there. Oh, okay. So just download.
Yeah, just download.
Much better. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just wanted to do it.
Oh, you end up in one browser?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And it was like I'm just scrolling. Well, we want to make sure we have it all. Yeah. So, is it working? The private caller is actually Ryan's phone, I guess. Is it broadcasting in here?
It's broadcast is coming from the conference call line.
The private caller.
So, when we first, like, I guess it was kind of early when we messed around with it, and when there was multiple things on, you'd get that.
Or feedback, like I did. Yeah. I follow you. John, I'll give you that document, that booklet if you want. I have a copy of it.
The
dance thing, yeah. So you can take a look at it. But I mean, I think the biggest thing that I don't feel that I can really get to about our model is the fact that the staff I work with, they've been with me, every one of them at least 10 years, and we do it every day, day in and day out. I think that's the real definer. Not about your education.
I know, right?
The question there is the variability between your office and the next.
I should be like, no, you hear you want that.
There is no. But I think there is a role for standardization. I am all for it. I mean, I really am. And that comes for us to take it offline. I think that's going to be in California, which, you know, I would love to.
Yeah. You checking our connection there for us before we get back to our meeting?
It looks good to me. I don't know if you guys can see my screen okay.
We were. At first it was great, you know.
Okay.
Can you make it bigger?
Yeah, I'm gonna maximize it. Can you see it okay now?
Yeah,
For the, those that are here, if you choose the second tab in the PDF on your laptop, you'll be able to
pull the video.
Or a third tab, yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
You'll, the third tab will appear.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so we will proceed again. It looks like the group's here in the room. Did Dr. Beanstalk, were you able to join the committee? Did we find out?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. And then Dr. Harris. Hi. Dr. Harris, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Okay.
Real quick, this is Ryan. Was Dr. Brownstein, was he present from the beginning?
No.
No.
I saw him pop up.
Yeah,
not when I did a roll call.
I'm here.
Okay, do you happen to have a time of when you joined? Approximate. 1301.
I don't think you heard you right.
Dr. Brownstein, do you happen to have an approximate time of when you joined the meeting?
I got like 1:30.
1:30. Okay, I appreciate it. Just for the record, and I just probably interrupt real quick. If you're going to leave, I know it sounds like an interruption, but you have to leave and then come back, kind of like Pat and Diana did during the board meeting, just announce it, especially now because it's in-person and virtual, it's hard to capture it for the minutes that we have to capture it for open meeting line. So, if you're giving up to go to the bathroom and coming right back, that's not required. But if it's if you're leaving for the rest of the meeting or for an extended period of time, it's helpful for us. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so Dr. Brady, it's you now for your presentation. Please do proceed.
All right. Well, no, I appreciate it. You know, Dr. Moore talked about things about reporting and how those things can help our the community of safety, and today I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about that. And I do have some disclosures. I am the co-chair and primary developer of 10 Minute Saves a Life app, even though we're not going to be really discussing that portion of it today. That might be in a different discussion. I'm also the director for the Dental Patient Safety Foundation, and that I will be talking about quite a bit today. Both of these foundations are nonprofit legal entities. Everyone's doing this completely volunteer, and all committees serve without any type of compensation, even our subcommittees as well. And so this is all just kind of like-minded people looking out for safety in our culture. And I don't have any other disclosures really to discuss for this presentation. You know, so I'll start out with what like a PSO is. The authority of the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Service, and in accordance with the Patient Safety Act of 2005, they work with the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality, and they make these PSO organizations that has to go through a very rigorous and stringent process to be able to be listed as a PSO. The Dental Patient Safety Foundation is a dental patient safety initiative that has a PSO status. And that's been around for about 3 years now, and the foundation is, again, just a nonprofit legal entity. And the thing with the PSOs is that it has to be limited by law to function only with one goal in mind, and that is to conduct activities to improve the quality and safety of dental care by the nonpartisan collecting, aggregating, and analyzing information about patient safety events. These patient safety events can confidentially, anonymously be reported on the website's reporting tool, and confidentially is guaranteed by the government. The information received cannot be seen or used in any legal, credentialing, or disciplinary body. It's about not making the same mistake twice. This is improving the transition from what happened and who did it to why did it happen and how can we prevent this from happening again. So it kind of pivots that focus quite a bit to the name, blame, and shame is replaced by shared learning. In patient safety events, we have incidents, near misses, and unsafe conditions. An incident is where a patient safety event that reaches a patient, whether or not harm was involved. As an example, if you gave a prescription of penicillin to a patient that actually had an allergy to a penicillin, this reached the patient, regardless if the patient took the drug or not, that would be considered an incident. The near misses are the close calls. Is when they don't reach the patient. So in this same example, the prescription was written, but maybe it was never given to the patient. It was caught ahead of time before it was actually given to them. And then a little lesser to that is going to be unsafe conditions or circumstances that increases the probability of occurring of that incident or that near miss. So if the patient record wasn't on the display when they were writing the script, or you didn't verbally check or confirm the situation, those are kind of the lower level things that elevate up to a near miss or to an incident. And Hendricks' law is based on probability and assumes that the number of accidents is proportionally to the severity of those accidents. It leads to the conclusion that if you minimize the number of minor incidents, these lower level things, it leads to a reduction in the major accidents, which is somewhat of a little bit of a misnomer, but it does help. It's not proportionate, but it does work, and it helps out. And the reason why is if you reduce those minor injuries, it reduces the overall injuries. But if you're looking at major injuries and fatalities, the top of that pyramid is a little more difficult to shift. To truly reduce those most serious incidents, there also has to be a focus on low frequency and high severity of consequences. Such events such as like operating heavy equipment, falling from great heights, electricity, or fire. We can learn and change our ways from near misses and unsafe conditions prior to the harm happening by studying those situations, those systems. So we don't have to wait for a person to be injured to necessarily fix a systematic problem. We can learn from the minor things to see and identify things that are happening. In fact, just on this call in itself, I'll get to later in my lecture, someone was asking about an airway fire and going through their career without ever seeing that. And so I'll bring that up as well. So it's kind of fitting. These incidents might be captured by registries or close claim reports, but that's all retrospective view. Only the PSOs can collect information about near misses, unsafe conditions that are protected from disclosure. This is what makes the DPSF stand out from other safety initiatives in dentistry. There's a lot of them out there, and they all have a good basis and good intent, but they don't have that protective level from disclosure or discovery from our government. So to talk about our example of airway fires, patient fires do happen, and it's really unfortunate. The spark during nitrous oxide analgesia is relatively uncommon, but have everlasting effect and patient impact. As of today, I know of 3 airway fires that have happened in the past year alone. And I know that DPSF has actually reported on an airway fire. In fact, it was just 2 days ago, I was doing a moderate sedation for a moderate sedation provider, actually. It was a patient that had some comorbidities. And when he went to go utilize the laser, I had him stop, and I did all the airway fire prevention protocols that I have before he started the laser. And he had never heard of an airway fire. He had no idea what that actually was. And he had been using the laser for many, many, many years. And it actually had him step back and think, well, wow, you know, I've been skating on thin ice for so many years. And I think a lot of that is a systematic failure where this isn't taught in dentistry. It's not taught in those classes, and I do believe that, because it wasn't about airway fire that I learned this prevention measures until I was in residency. So even though from my dental school, I've never heard of airway fires, and we were using nitrous oxide all the time, that oxygen pooling can and does occur, unfortunately. You know, Harvard, they did a publication when things go wrong, and they've studied all of their hospitals. And what they came back was a sounding conclusion that these, we have to make change to improve to our systems. We have to make a continuous effort for this and just always examine ourselves and have reflection, even if we think that we're doing our best. And really what they were seeing is that a lot of these initiatives, the fear, shame, and blame, and legal actions causes a lot of confusion about causation and responsibilities, because we all make mistakes and we all are human. And so trying to bridge that gap is a big effort. The aviation has seen this and has worked on this for many, many years, and it's been very, very impactful. It's probably one of the most impactful things to the community of safety that we've seen in any industry and in nuclear power as well. But the primary mission for the Federal Aviation Administration is to promote aviation safety. To further this mission, the FAA instituted a volunteer aviation safety reporting program. And when they did this, they didn't have many people report, because there wasn't an incentive for them to really get in there and take the time to report. And there was some confusion about self-reflection and biases, and did I do something wrong, and what if I report this, and does it get discovered? What will happen with that? And so they ended up partnering with NASA to have a third party have it separately removed, and the ASRP effectively would be greatly enhanced by NASA rather than the FAA, because they could accomplish the receipts, processing, and analysis of the raw data. It would ensure anonymity of the reports of all the parties that were involved in the incident's consequence, and increase the flow of information necessary to have an effective evaluation on safety and efficacy of the system. Accordingly, NASA designed and administered the ASRS to perform these functions, and they created a memorandum of understanding of the FAA back in 1975. And this memorandum, this agreement between the two, is what really projected this project forward. You know, when the FAA, they're responsible for inserting actions such as the state board, right? They discover something and they have to do something to protect the public. But a lot of those enforcement actions, they take into account the attitude of the violator and also the response of what that violator did. So I'm sure at the state board level, they always see, what did you do after this event? And what is your attitude toward the infraction, right? Are you teachable? Are you learnable? Are you going to be able, do you even recognize that you did something wrong? I'm sure all of those things come into the Enforcement Act at the dental level board as well to take into consideration. So what the Aviation Safety Reporting Program has, this memorandum of understanding with the Federal Aviation Administration, that if these four conditions are met, that essentially it gives some kudos or whatever you want to call it to the violator. It helps that person out to make sure that they ensure community of safety. And the after effect of doing this is what caused a ton of reports and a lot of things found within system failures to help the community. So the four contingencies of this, though, is you have to make sure that it's an inadvertent and a non-deliberative action. The violation could not be criminal, and it could not be committed within a period of 5 years of another violation. So if they already had a violation, this wouldn't help you out if it was in that same 5 years. Kind of like getting a speeding ticket and being able to go to online, driver school. And the other contingency of that, too, is that you have to have reported that violation within 10 days to a PSO. And so I'll go through the process of what that looks like, but essentially it gets all de-identified and you get a receipt. So if those conditions are met, you essentially get not a get out of jail free card, but you get some leniency on you because you're showing not just the attitude of the violator, but what actions you did to help ensure the community of safety. Out of all of these presentations that we hear, we always want information and how to disseminate that information. And historically, how this happened in aviation, it started with someone just recognizing, hey, we have a lot of safety issues in aviation, and it's hard to really describe and get too granular on what exactly have the upticks been in aviation that's caused issues in these systems. And so this started way back in the 60s, and they described it as the sleeping giant. And a lot of people were fear of legal liability to try to help improve those systems. So once this came into effect, you had a massive reporting of events, and they've received over 1.5 million reports through NASA, and aviation has been the safest that it has ever been because of this. And you can look at the intakes, the monthly intakes of the ASRP and how much that they have contributed. So how this works in aviation, if you have a near miss or a close call or even something that's not an infraction or against the FAA regulations, so if anyone's in aviation, you know that there's airspaces that you can clip into, like Class Bravo, without permission. There's little things that you could have done that you may not know if anyone saw you or didn't see you, or just little things that you notice of other people that are doing. Anything that's a hazardous situation or an unsafe occurrence can get reported. And the benefit of reporting it, if it happens to you, is that it gets de-identified, it gets date stamped, it gets screened, and then someone from the ASRP will go back to the initial report and analyze it to match it to a category within dentistry. It could be subspecialties as well of what that incident was. And then they actually codify the information to make sure that it's something that can be discovered and researched and looked at amongst other parties, because after it's been de-identified, then the instruction of the original documents are completely destroyed, and then a receipt is granted back to the recipient. And so there's a certified report with a date, time, and stamp, and a certification number that only the initial receiver, the initial person that put in that report, will have. So if an infraction was to happen and it came onto the board, they could have a proof of that receipt that they did something to help the community out because of some mishap that happened. Now, it doesn't always mean that you get out of jail free or you get leniency. It depends on the grievances and other, like how egregious the situation was. But a lot of times it helps with those near misses. And within that database, you really start to find out things like airway fires some people have never heard of. And then all of a sudden you hear of three of them. And we know that there's so many people out there using lasers in dentistry that they've been skating on thin ice for many, many years and not realizing what protocols should be in place when combining analgesia with nitrous oxide and utilizing a laser. And so the Dental Patient Safety Foundation is one of those organizations that can aggregate this information, have it protected with the PSO status, and give people a receipt and confidence. I think the way to make this have teeth at the dental board is to do something similar that aviation has done. Even if it's just something as simple as saying that we would consider it if you were to contribute to the community. So that is my report. Over on the right is everyone that is involved with the Dental Patient Safety Foundation. And also, Jeff Brownstein is one of our subcommittees on that panel as well. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Dr. Brady. For the committee members, questions, comments?
This is Alvin Guy. Thank you. That was a great presentation. Thank you very much. I had a similar experience as you did with being in a dentist's office and talking about airway fire and the dentist that uses lasers, like airway fire. So it is important, and it brings up, there's a lot of correlation that gets talked about regarding aviation procedure. And there's a lot, from being in dental office, I know there's a lot more checks and balances in a OR, a hospital, or a surgery center than there necessarily is in a dental office. And I don't know if that is just more education. I think the fire, speaking about airway fire, is definitely something that word needs to get out as lasers get used more and more everybody's put on the protective eye here, but they're not thinking about the airway fire. Then something as simple as I know a lot of dental offices, I offer to do a surgical timeout, and that's not something that they normally do, making sure you have the right patient and you're doing the right procedure and consented and all that. So, there's definitely a lot of education to bring what they use in the aviation world to, the medical community and the dental community. So,
Well, thank you. And I think that's the whole message behind this is there's little things that are out there that creep up on us that people don't know about. And if we have those upticks for people trying to protect themselves in a sense, but also helps protect the community, then you do get an influx of reporting and those reports can be generated and pushed out to the community. And I think that's what makes a difference between all these other volunteer bases, of even registries versus like having reports. The PSO is what actually protects the person. And if you had it where the state dental board would actually help you in those types of situations, because we're all human, we make like little mistakes and things can happen, but at least I have some buy-in or some skin in the game to say, okay, I'm going to take the time to report incidences, and this is going to help the community, in a sense, could help me too if I get myself in a pinch.
This is Blazek, and I was just going to ask Dr. German. I know you and I had spoke about how every day, at the end of the day, you guys go through a list about all the cases you did. Is it something similar or not as detailed, or can you comment about what you guys do?
Yeah, hey, this is German. So we have, for every case that we do, we have a sheet that we have to write on either no complications or these complications occurred. And we have a list of 100 plus complications by organ system, actually, that we have to go through if there was, in fact, a complication. And that's for every single patient that gets provided. All of that gets provided to a database called Wake Up Safe, which is a pediatric anesthesia database.
And this is Goodman. So, Dr. German, to clarify, that is in the hospital setting or as the pediatric anesthesiologist or both?
Both.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments or questions from the committee for Dr. Brady?
Hey, Dr. Brady, this is Christensen. Thanks so much for putting that together. It was excellent. I know that having some family members that are pilots and things like that, there is a lot of similarities between safety, obviously, in the airplane as well as in the operating room setting. So thanks for putting that together. Thank you.
I appreciate that. My next step really is to talk to someone from the FAA and legal to see, is there something that we can do, those statutes that could be potentially that the Arizona State Board of Dentistry could consider doing something. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with Dental Patient Safety Foundation, but some type of PSO reporting that actually helps drive that flow of information where it can be dissected by professionals and disseminated out.
Just a comment about Ali's discussion about the differences in the OR and the surgery center and what have you. And I can safely say, I think that the biggest reason there's so much prudence put in the operating room and the surgery center is because of oversight. And that is not something that has come into the dental industry yet. And hence, I think another good point about why is that not in the statutes, whether it deals with anesthesia or it deals with the, the standard of care. And so I think you bring up a good point. And having dealt in both fields of dentistry and medicine, I can safely tell you that is why dentistry, there is no required timeout. There is no checklist manifesto. There is none of these things, although documents are produced like one-offs. There's no mandated, which if it was mandated, if it was in statute, then it's enforceable. So I'm glad you brought it up because there's a huge difference.
Yeah, and there's punitive results if you don't do it.
From insurance reimbursement, everything. Yeah.
Medicare, if you don't report quality numbers by a certain metric, they pay you less. So it's, yeah.
This is Dr. Snell. Just to put on record, I don't think all regulations lead to more patient safety. I think in dentistry, we have an extremely safe way of treating patients. So, yeah, and this is good. And I think that if we ask for JCO or any of those organizations to start regulating dentistry, it could make access to care considerably diminished.
Yeah, my thought on a lot of this stuff is more of recommendation than education as opposed to mandates, you know, getting the word out there so that people are aware of. Here we are.
Yeah. And it's no, I talked about Brady's presentation so much. It gives us a way to put out information without feeling like, oh my gosh, I did something wrong, I'm going to be punished for it. And when that information gets out, that leads to better education and knowledge without having to put more regulations and stipulations and things on the provider.
Yeah, and it stays volunteer, which is a beautiful part of that.
Right. Yeah, and part of how standard of care works is it doesn't have to be legislated. It can happen within your community, and then that becomes what you're held against. So, we can get to the end in different ways. So, thank you. Thanks again, Dr. Brady, for the presentation. All right, Mr. Edmondson, for you, keeping score at home here or in the meeting. Do we have a third presentation today?
Steph and I were trying to determine that, and I think it's only determined if Dr. Stitt Harris is present. But I don't see him on the call. I could be wrong. Dr. Harris, are you with us virtually? I'm going to assume not.
Okay.
This is the same presentation that you saw during the board meeting, and they pumped it to this committee. The materials in the packet, I don't know if you guys need an actual verbal presentation by Dr. Harris to discuss this. I think that, and I may be wrong, Dr. Christensen and Dr. Blaine, because I've seen before, if I'm not mistaken. But I don't know if you guys have comments on the material. Essentially, what is it that you would like us to do? He's wanting to get the information validated.
Yep. Hi, this is Skip Harris.
Okay, excuse me. You too. Thank you.
Yeah, Dr. Harris, so welcome. I appreciate you being here and being willing to present. Many on the committee are familiar with the material, and of course a handful of us were there for the board meeting. So if you could share with us a condensed version with the understanding that you're likely then to get multiple questions. So.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to repeat everything that's in the letter that I presented to the board. I guess what I'd like the distinguished committee to know is that I've been studying this subject matter for 12 and a half years, and I have been collecting data through personal interviews and through public data searches. That has allowed me to have some research that I'm sorry, I'm getting a lot of feedback, that I was preparing to present to you guys at the request of one of the board staff members. And I started to see some patterns come out that alarmed me and caused me to feel like I should go directly to the board because I felt like maybe there was a public safety risk. So there are a number of different conclusions that I think I was able to draw from studying the data that I had collected personally. One being that Arizona is fantastically safe and that there's a lot of anesthesia going on in dentistry in the state of Arizona that's very safe and very effective. And I think we're doing a wonderful job. But there are places that we can do better. And one of the bigger concerns that I had was there appears to be a disproportionately high number of fatalities with CRNAs and untrained general dentists that represented about 50% of the fatalities over the last 7 years. And I guess that concerned me enough that I felt the need to present it emergently, because I think there might be some action that needs to be taken quickly. With that said, my study is anything but complete and anything but perfect. And so what I was actually hoping that the board would recommend was that I be allowed to officially verify my data so that I could present to this committee not just data that I've collected unofficially, but actually, you know, present data that was collected from an official source and presented in an official way. And so here I am offering to try to put some actual numbers to a subject that is discussed about in kind of an anecdotal way.
To clarify, Dr. Harris, your hope is to validate the data, and how would you go about that? And other than, yay, please go do that, find out, what are you looking for from the board or the committee or both?
Sure. Well, I'm actually quite confident that the data that I've collected is accurate, perhaps not entirely complete. So, for example, I don't have perfect data on how many males and females had adverse events in the last 12 and a half years, because I wasn't able to get a hold of every dentist that's had an adverse event in the last 12 and a half years. So there are some holes in my data when it comes to what I would call uneventful points of data. So for fatalities, for serious emergencies, I was able to get a hold of all of those doctors and interview them or develop information about those cases pretty successfully. But I don't have complete data because I wasn't able to get a hold of everyone. So if you're asking me what do I need to make that happen, I simply need the case files for all the adverse events that the board still has so that I can mine through it and confirm the data that I've already collected and fill in any, you know, demographic holes that are missing.
Okay, this is Goodman again. Is there something specific about your research, your interest, and what you're finding that would be distinct to Arizona that isn't already readily available or accessible in other parts of the nation that we could make the same conclusions that others have?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you asking, are there studies like this in other states?
Yeah, there are studies like this in other states, parts of the country, the nation.
Yes.
So that rather than starting a study, we could take data that's already available.
So there were blue ribbon panels in California and Texas over the last few years that identified the safety data in a similar fashion to what I have done. That have been published, but I don't think those, you know, data points really assist us in knowing what's happened in Arizona.
Yes, and I, you know, being maybe the only non-clinician on the committee, probably, I wonder whether it happened in Arizona, is that essential to our discussion? So, why don't we for a moment allow the committee to discuss the concept and the potential need of what's already available as well as what you might be able to contribute. So open that up for the committee for thoughts, comments.
And if I may, yeah, I think you'll find the California and the Texas study concur with our study. I don't think our data is presenting anything particularly new. We appear to fall within line with the other studies.
Okay, so what you found initially, you feel like is aligned. Okay, thank you.
This is Alan Guy. One of my colleagues spoke at the board meeting, talked about this, so I won't get into too much refuting some of this information, but some things that I think are important for the committee to be aware of, and I don't speak with great detail on the events, but the two CRNA deaths, from what I understand, was with the same provider. And the two events weren't directly related to the anesthesia. One was the airway fire that we've been talking about. The other one was the reaction of local anesthesia. So those are certainly shared responsibilities. It seems like a great leap from that to saying all CRNAs should be stopped essentially from doing anesthesia in dental offices
by holding a 1304 permit. So that's one piece of it. Another piece, you know, like I keep hearing this untrained dentist. Nothing against my orthopedic surgeon's friends, but a joke is when you follow two orthopedic surgeons read an EKG, a double-blind study. So it's not like the other surgeons that we work with are, you know, anesthesia experts like oral surgeons would be. So CRNAs are working with, you know, quote-unquote untrained providers every day with excellent safety results. And then, you know, the mention of the big holes and kind of go into the concern of, you know, who should lead this process. You know, I wasn't quite clear, Dr. Harris, when I read your report here, and I wasn't present at the board meeting when you presented, so maybe it was covered there. But I'm unclear on the cases that were thrown out, that you didn't feel like there was anything that could have possibly been done to avoid those deaths. So, you know, when we talk about the holes, I think that every adverse event needs to be counted and investigated. I don't think, you know, you can just say, well, these skew the data because, you know, I decided that they would have happened no matter what.
That's not what I was saying at all. May I clarify?
Sure, that'd be great.
A couple of things. One, I am absolutely positively not anti-CRNA. I think CRNAs are awesome, and I'm completely in favor of CRNAs working in an appropriate environment, and I'm not trying to throw anything towards the CRNAs. If anything, I'm throwing some dispersion towards the general dentists that I think are actually less trained than the average medical doctor when it comes to potential life-threatening complications during sedation. And to point one more comment, you asked about holes in my data. Please forgive me. The holes in my data that I was talking about are actually what I would describe as an abundance of caution transportation. So somebody who has chest pain but no other symptoms, and they send them to the ER, and the patient isn't even admitted. And so the recollection of the doctor 5 years later is not very good. So the places in my study that have the weakest data are data points that are what I would describe as an abundance of caution type transportation and report, not one that had learning points or interesting medical, you know, teaching points. I originally started this study looking for things that I could teach other oral surgeons how to avoid. But the reality is that a vast, vast, vast majority of the adverse events that are reported in the state of Arizona are nothing cases. They're abundance of caution adverse events admissions that don't even result in the patient staying in the emergency room for more than a few hours.
All right. Thank you.
This is Layla. So thanks, Dr. Harris, for putting the information together and providing it. I do think, as I read through the document and I see the way Dr. Harris has identified the permit holders, the method of anesthetic, and what have you, it does more parallel the Blue Ribbon studies, which I think if we're going to do a real study in the state of Arizona, it should do that. And that is one of the things that the board has already in our documents for this meeting that I'm sure we're going to get to. So I do appreciate that this study is quite a bit more in depth than what we've been provided in the past, and be this accurate, inaccurate, however you want to look at it. With all respect to Dr. Harris, one person does not make a panel. And so I'm complimentary of the data. I think the data is important, and I certainly think it's eye-opening in terms of the number of adverse occurrences we've had in this state over 12 and a half years, and in particular, the change in those adverse occurrences since the last time we rewrote the statutes in 2012. So I like the data, I'm appreciative of the data, but I think that we're going to provide this type of information. It needs to be more on a comprehensive nature, that you don't just have one person doing the study. And we have a great opportunity with this board to have that influence, because it is the most diverse organization that we've ever accumulated to address the statutes of anesthesia and sedation in the state of Arizona for dentistry.
Thank you.
I would love the help.
This is German. I echo Dr. Blazik. I think the call to obtain the information of these cases, I think, is paramount to the
success and to the recommendation of this committee and to the patient safety of the community that we provide services to. I think this committee needs to have the details of all the cases of adverse outcomes and death in this state. I just don't see how we can function. I don't see how we can appropriately make any recommendations for patient safety without reviewing them. We have to do a root cause analysis. We can de-identify the data. That doesn't matter, but we need to see the data.
This is Beanstalk. I was just going to say the same thing and ask how we can make this more comprehensive.
Does anyone know how many weeks, months, years it took Texas or California? Please, I don't know how many, but I can find out real quick. Because the head of it, Dr. Ernie Luce, was my resident training, my attendee. I can text him and get that information before. Real quick.
This is Blazik, and I think that's really important information to know, as well as how we get it paid for and what have you. But as a one-off, I think that is item number, it's a different item number on the agenda where we're going to talk about the study. So I might suggest that we reserve that discussion until that time, as opposed to currently we're in public session still. Am I not misunderstanding that?
I think we... Are we staying in public session?
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So,
and if there's number four.
Yeah. Yeah. So we can discuss more on what happened on the study. I guess my hesitation is if the precursor, what we found out so far with Dr. Harris, aligned with what California and Texas already is done, as much as we might have the interest in what's happened specifically in Arizona, it's hard for me to understand why we need to build it here. If safety and access to care both continue to be, you know, our priorities in appropriate ways, can't we use what's already been researched to figure it out? What to do?
This is German. I don't think so. It sounds like we can. Since the last changes, we continue to have problems, right? Patients are still dying. They're still having adverse events. So, and we're charged with changing how anesthesia is practiced in dental offices. So we need to look at what has happened and decide why those things have happened and make changes appropriately. Otherwise, my opinion, we're blindly shooting at targets we can't see.
I might echo what Dr. German said, but also I think that we have a unique opportunity on a national level to make a real impact. So the nation is not going to change anesthesia practices, be it that those are state by state requirements. But if we have kind of like the best committee and we do the best study, why can't that come from Arizona? And that be a leader for all other states to follow.
Okay. All right. Well,
this is Dr. Harris. If I may, the collection of this data is basically in two forms. One is one that doesn't require a large committee and doesn't require high fashion statistics. I mean, it's basically how many men, how many women, how many oral surgeons, how many general dentists, how many CRNAs, how many fatalities. It's just counting numbers. But they get much more complicated when you dig into the case and you attempt to define what was the complication and what was the outcome. So if you're trying to do a study where you're just trying to look at, are there any patterns? Are there any, you know, issues that are easily definable by the demographics of the data? That's actually quite easy and quite transparent and is basically what was provided by the California and the Texas studies.
Yeah, and now Dr. Harris, so you have the adverse events, those that you're aware of and that you've researched. Do you have with that the total number of cases by type of clinician?
Yes, yes. And it's provided in the document there.
What? Estimated.
It's estimated, and what I think with Dr. Snell is estimated, because what Dr. Harris has done is all on his own without the help of any official dental board or any regulatory body that can give him that information. So all he's left to do is to be able to estimate.
But I would caution you that much of the study is actually pulled from board minutes. So there are many official, you know, data points that are in it. It's just not as comprehensive as I would like.
Yeah, I guess the mathematical concern I would have is we're saying, okay, there's this many adverse occurrences with this type of licensee, but are we including how many of the total cases are done by that type of licensee?
Well, the denominator.
Yeah, yes, it's there.
That's the part that worries me is if all children die in heart surgery when it's being done by a pediatric cardiologist, I don't know that I'd be that surprised because that's who does heart surgery. And so if we're talking today about multiple types of parties that administer anesthesia, I think we need to know that part of the number to make any conclusions. And that's what I didn't quite understand at the board meeting or today is total number, not of events, but total number of cases that didn't have events later, you know.
And that vector, that data point is something that nobody knows nationally. We have some estimations with the oral surgeons, but that is the weakness of every study that has come out. We are guessing how many total number of sedations are done in a year by a given profession. What I can tell you is I don't think we'll ever have great numbers on that. And I haven't attempted to define, you know, exactly how many fatalities per 100,000 patients each specialty does. I think the number is around 1 in 400,000 because that's the number that the Oral Surgery Insurance Society uses. But that number will always be problematic to ascertain.
Okay. You know, I have a question, maybe for this group can help me understand. Research is incredibly valuable and powerful, right? Time and money is also. And I'm just trying to figure out what a big study here in Arizona is going to tell us that we didn't already learn from California and Arizona and the actuaries that Dr. Harris just mentioned regarding, for insurance. I just having more knowledge is incredible, but what are we going to learn that's different from Texas and California?
We're going to learn that we're doing it right.
Or maybe an area where we're not doing it right. Like, I don't really know if California or Texas has this 1304 permit process, or how is there a difference than ours? I'm not really sure, to be honest.
That's probably easier to find out than to...
Mm-hmm. I think this is Dr. Harris again. If you read my study, I've actually identified a couple of areas that I do think are worthy of the committee's attention. And I do think are worth discussing because I think we can actually improve safety. But that doesn't minimize the power of being able to present to the world that Arizona has a similar safety record to everybody else and that we're doing it well and that we don't have unusual outliers. And if we do, we address them immediately.
Christensen, thanks, Dr. Harris, for joining us today. I would like to echo, I think we do need a study. I think we're talking about our own study, talking about perhaps affecting how people live their lives and provide care for patients. And we're talking about making changes. I think we need to have the facts. And it returns exactly to our state and what we're doing here as providers and professionals. So that would be my recommendation. Count me in.
This is one more point, Dr. Harris. The last two CRNA events that occurred, as Ali had mentioned, are those in your study or no?
Well, okay, so both of those have happened so recently that board action is still pending. So none of the information that I have is is from official sources because the official sources haven't gone through the board yet. They haven't gone through. So my data is incomplete on those two most recent fatalities. However, I have done extensive research personally on both of them, and I know a lot about them, and I did include them in this paper, but the data is not as complete as I would like it to be.
But they are included. Okay.
They are included in the data that's there, because I basically focused on the big picture. I wasn't trying to dig too deep in. So I didn't say why was there an airway fire. I just said airway fire.
Okay.
All right. You know, there are a couple of things from this study that I think would be valuable that potentially be immediate action. One we've already talked about, which is trying to educate dentists about the risk of airway fire. I'm sure Dr. Brady has some great information on that that we could potentially, I don't know if there's a way to get board approval and blast, you know, some education material out there to, hey, this can happen to you. The other thing that I think is valuable that you mentioned in this study is the lack of knowledge by dentists that they would require a permit. My group gets phone calls all the time by dentists that want us to come in there tomorrow. And the very first thing my group does is we go on the board website, we search, and, hey, sorry, you don't have a permit. And they get, sometimes they get angry. Well, other people come in here. Other people are other people. So, you know, I think there's a lot of dentists that don't realize that. And of course, as Dr. Harris mentioned in the report, one of these events was in an office that didn't have a permit. So I think it would be valuable to educate the dental community in Arizona on those two items.
Wait, Mr. Cummings, does that fall under the Arizona Dental Association, really, than it does the board, or what are your thoughts on that? Can we make recommendations to the Arizona Dental Association?
Well, sure. I'm sure they'd love for us to make recommendations. We just don't have any control. And whereas in the idea of helping the dentists with their licenses and, you know, that education seems appropriate for the board, but for the committee, we can make that recommendation to the board to make the recommendation. Mr. Edmondson, is that basically the structure of how it works?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. All right, yeah. So as far as the committee, for those two educational items, are those things that we're all able to be in agreement on that we could ask the board to take up? Airway fires and education on the need to have a permit.
If I may, the airway fires are extraordinarily unusual, and in the last 12 and a half years, there's only been one, and it's an extraordinarily unusual event. I think that we could focus on things that are more common.
Well, I have to disagree with you. I know of three airway fires in the past year. I think it's one of those events that maybe they don't get reported or they don't know about it or it doesn't lead to an incident to the board. But I think things are more common than what we know.
Yeah, I'd like to comment. This is Lau. Our national organization, AAPD, has put together a policy on patient safety, and we've got some good documents regarding fire safety and incidents in dental offices or ORs or surgery centers. I can track down some of that data or those documents and submit them to the board. But we're cognizant of it at the national level. We have one of the people in the work group is out of California, and she's got some pretty good articles because she's kind of does this kind of stuff anyway. So I can get those to the board for review at the next meeting.
Thank you.
This is Brady again. Harris, I wanted to say thank you for your report. I mean, it is insightful to know some of this information. And you look at things, and sometimes you get kind of cued into maybe this person hasn't really taken the time to do a preoperative checklist to make sure all systems are met, kind of like a pre-flight checklist in an aviation as well. And I think a lot of people skate on thin ice for long periods of time. So I do appreciate the effort and work that you put into your report. And I like to have information. I think Ali has a valid point is what do you do with that data as it's interpreted? The raw data itself may be very, very good, valuable information, and I'm about having that, but also have to be very careful on conclusions and how that data is interpreted.
Agreed. This is Dr. Harris. I completely agree. In my report, there are actually four focus items that I, as a clinician, parsed out of the data. And I would encourage the committee to read those because there are a couple of big issues that actually caused multiple fatalities, such as poor preoperative evaluation, which I personally think is something the committee could address and may actually change the fatality rate. I do think there's stuff in my study that is actionable, and I would encourage you guys to read those action items and you know, contemplate them and maybe discuss them in committee.
This is German. I agree. You know, this committee is charged with reviewing and potentially changing preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative management of patients under sedation, and the details of all of these cases could influence, the changes that we make. So the study is a great idea, but I think more importantly as a committee and what we're being tasked with, the information from those cases is of paramount, importance for our efforts as a committee. I would actually move to ask our chairman to petition the board to get that information of the patient.
This is Blazing. The only thing I would, as opposed to seconding the move, I would want to clarify more directly what information we're looking for. What the staff has provided already, I would want to expound on it.
So if I could maybe have you hold off on your motion until we decide for, and then we can cover more appropriately kind of what the study looks like, if that's okay. Considering we're still talking about Dr. Harris's report, it would make more sense when we have to have the
assessment. Dr. Snell, just Mr. Goodman answered your question about the Texas Blue Room panel. Dr. Liu said it took about 6 months from the time that the board staff collected information to the Blue Room panel being formed to them meeting five times, once a month, so 5 months, and then putting the report together.
Oh, okay. So we'll remember this meeting when it's done. I mean, because that was my worry, is that it could be multiple years, and we might all, it might take, but I mean, if it's something that could be done in a...
And that's in the state of Texas, where there's double at least the number of the anesthesia cases being done.
Okay. So let's not, it's not California bureaucracy. I'll let you go.
Well, I think it may even be recorded, so good luck to you.
This is Dr. Harris. I mean, we're talking about 49 data points. Three people could sit down in an afternoon and confirm my data.
Yes, that may be true on that part. Let's do this. Let's move to item four, because we do need to get some insight from the staff on the ability to get the information together from their perspective. I mean, that's really what, we'll turn that over to you, Mr. Edmondson, and your staff on what we have here on item four.
Okay, and you're probably gonna want stuff maybe to screw from. I'll say I prefer stuff chiming in on some of this just based on the legality of having access to some of these files, especially the ones that have reported as adverse occurrences, but also were dismissed because of no violation found and how we add that into a study. There is also an additional layer in that last board meeting, our president formed another committee for, the rules committee. And so now, that committee has been formed to add information regarding the rules for the notice of proposed rulemaking. So while I think that the board should be the one that makes the final decision, I don't even know if we're going to make recommendations. You guys are going to make recommendations to the board for which direction we should go. I think it's easier to do it through rule than statute, but that's on that committee's agenda as opposed to the board. So it's just another layer of a distributed.
Oh, we can just make recommendations to that committee, to the board, to everybody. I'm a little flippant, but in the end, let's figure out what the recommendations are.
Yeah. Go from there. And then the framework and the guidelines, this is what I think Dr. German actually had requested this to be placed on the agenda, to come up with framework guidelines. And now that Dr. Harris is here, perhaps there is some input that he could help provide on the strategy and the data points.
Well, this is Blake. I even think some of the points that Dr. Moore brought up in his presentation could be added to this. And I think these are items that are completely de-identifiable. So, you know, again, with all due respect to our council, I'm not sure why, if you don't have the person's name, social security number, phone number, and address on there, there's a problem with knowing specifics of the adverse event or occurrence. Items such as, you know, the medical history of the patient, you know, where there's special circumstances about their history and stuff. So, I mean, I think we jump into this document you have here about the case number, the specialty of the dentist, if any, the permit type, number of providers, age of patient, and we add to that items that we would request to think fulfill a proper study. And you're right, with Dr. Harris on the phone and his study, that only adds to items that we can put on here. It's more comprehensive, I think. And many of these things overlap.
This is Beanstalk. Could the board staff and certain consultants gather the official data that we're looking for?
Yes, Dr. Beanstalk, I think that some of the hope is to determine what we are looking for, so that, and then probably get some, in this discussion, initial feedback on the board staff's perception on being able to get that information. And I think that's why Mr. Edmondson was suggesting we might hear from the staff attorney.
Are we looking to officially validate Dr. Harris's study, basically?
I think that some of that's to be open and discussed still, because we need to determine what information we're trying to get, you know, just framework wise on past cases, and we're still trying to work through that. But if we may, let's see if we could turn it to Seth for the legal advice that Mr. Edmondson was suggesting.
If the committee can come up with a list of which items it wants to see specifically, I can go through the statute, board's rule, if anything can be provided. But until there's a comprehensive list of exactly what you're looking for, it's kind of tough to do that kind of on the fly.
Okay, so to restate, we missed some of your words, but to restate, it sounds like you're saying have the committee come up with a list. After the committee meeting, you'll review to get some feedback on what's obtainable based on the statute and the rules.
Right. There could be some information that could be provided that may need to be acted first, but without really knowing specifically or it's kind of tough to pine upon whether or not that can be provided.
Okay, thank you. So let's do that as a committee. Let's move to what items are we looking for in the framework guidelines to first have the staff let us know what's happened in Arizona. So we have a list here of case numbers. So we have that, specialty of dentist, if any, permit type, number of providers involved in the administration of the anesthesia, if able to be determined, age of patient, and outcome of the case. Please, go ahead.
This is Dr. Snell. So these are items that we want to know from, what are we wanting the board to gather? All negative occurrences, all reported occurrences, only sedation involved, all bad outcomes involved in dental. Like, I think we need to establish that first for the board, and then we can go to what items from those cases we want to pull out. But if we're saying, do we want every adverse event that happened in the dental office because they didn't have an AED but sedation wasn't involved at all, or are we only looking for when it was a permit provider? Are we only looking for if, you know, maybe it wasn't a permit provider, someone can just give Valium and there was an adverse occurrence? What do we want the board to pull or look at first, and then we can pull the items from that?
I think this is lazy. I think that what we're requesting to understand is what are the significant morbidity or mortality issues under the adverse occurrence reporting requirements we currently have. That's what I would say we look at.
So only regards to sedation when it's reported to the board.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just draw down a list that maybe we could all agree on. I have in my mind what we would want to know and the adverse events. You know, I'd like to know the qualifications of the dentist who is doing the procedure. Is it a surgeon? Is it a periodontist? Is it a general dentist? Who is that? I'd like to know if there was dedicated anesthesia, and if there was, what type of anesthesia provider was it? Was it a dentist, an oral surgeon? Was it an MD or a CRNA? I'd like to know the setting. Was it an office? Was it a surgery center? Was it a hospital? I imagine most of these things reported were an office, but I don't know for certain. And then I'd like to know details of the event. I'd like to know the patient's history, what the procedure was, and what type of anesthesia was that. In my mind, those are all the things that are going to factor in.
This is German. I think Dr. Moore's list was very comprehensive. It included everything you said, including the type of monitors used, type of medications used. I assume that his words are in the minutes. You can just mirror his list. I mean, very comprehensive list.
But it didn't have it for each event.
No, it should be. It's for each event.
It should be for each event.
This is Dr. Harris. I will tell you that having done a bunch of these adverse events as a consultant, some of that data is not going to be present in the medical record. For example, I have never seen the brand of monitor or listed on a medical record.
Type of monitors, pulse oximetry, whether infantile CO2 or whether it's recordial stethoscope, type of monitor.
Yeah, I just would caution you. You'd be astounded how bad the documents are.
Well, it's worth looking at.
Nevertheless,
yeah, I agree, Dr. German. Yeah. The thing I might add, because Ali, you mentioned the setting, and I do think it's really important that we have the setting, but I think to make the generic term an office is not adequate. I think we should really define it as an oral surgeon's office, a dental office, a pediatric office, or there are some dental offices that are dedicated to providing anesthesia. You know, so when we come to this idea of listing the setting that the anesthetic took place in, I would request that it's broken down into those subtitles. I think also Dr. Moore mentioned that you didn't have all these, but about the personnel involved. If we know it's a dental anesthesiologist and it's a dentist or an oral surgeon, who else was in the room? Were there other assistants involved? Did they have any level of training or certification? Like I think all of you mentioned about their level of training as far as periodontist, oral surgeon, et cetera.
Again, that won't be present in the medical record.
I'd love to see it listed as one of our requests. If it's not there, it's not there. It doesn't mean that adverse occurrence shouldn't be considered. Maybe that might say, hey, this is something for us to look at, and it's documented. I know in most offices, we'll indicate even which room we do the anesthetic in, as opposed to just, you know, Palm Valley oral surgery, room 1, 2, 3, 4. Just like in the hospital, they indicate which surgical room they use, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 through 15. And I think that's important. And then I think what was also important for Dr. Moore mentioned in his study was, or the study in California, was the intended level of anesthesia as opposed to the actual level of anesthesia. And again, it may not be in the record, but I think that's important for us to look at. And I, with all due respect to everybody here and on the phone in the room, I'm just throwing things at the wall. And I'm hoping what sticks, and what Mr. Hargrave looked at, and he can say, you know, 90% of this you can't look at, well, then so be it. But I would welcome us to throw everything at the wall, put it on this list, and at the end of the day, if we walk away with 9 items, great.
Blasek, this is Brady. I just have one question for you, too. I know that some providers have third-party accreditation status as well. Is that something that you would want to look at? Because I think that is probably going to be an important factor. If we're trying to draw conclusions and if we have statistical power to do so.
This is Blasek again. I don't think it's not a bad idea to put it on there as far as the center where the anesthetic was provided. But I would tell you most of, as you know, most facilities that are doing this, no one has accreditation.
Okay, so this is Brady again. Is John Dovgan with us today? I see his name there. I know that he's been super involved for a very long time in this, and I just wanted to kind of hear his opinion. I think you're muted.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
There's a couple things that I want to pose, because I've done 18 adverse outcome cases throughout the United States, of which 6 were sedation. And I've done 3 here in Arizona.
Is this Dr. Dovgan?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're kind of breaking up some.
How about now?
We'll is that see. Better?
Okay. I've done 18.
This is Dr. Harris. I'm sorry. I have to run to see another patient. My apologies for cutting you guys short.
We appreciate it, Dr. Harris. Thank you.
Good day.
About 18 different adverse outcome cases in the nation. I've done 3 adverse outcome cases as a consultant for the Arizona State Board of Dental Examiners. And I see a pattern every single time that I've actually presented on different papers throughout the United States. But 3 things we really want to really integrate is Dr. Harris had a point when he said that the no monitoring or monitoring, there's so many times where there's absolutely no monitoring at all. And we talked about capnography or post oximetry at least. Capnography is becoming more of the standard throughout the United States. And I think 2 of the other things we have to talk about is the fact that the dental team didn't have any training. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Apricot study from Europe that talks about a 1.34 higher incidence of severe critical outcomes or events when the team didn't have any training at all. That's one of the things I found in dental offices. And the other thing I found in dental offices is lack of equipment. They don't have the equipment necessary. And let's say outside provider comes in, is not a dental anesthesiologist, is not necessarily.
Yeah, it's breaking up enough, and I don't know that this is getting us to where we need to go on this discussion.
I'm sorry you couldn't hear it. I just wanted to give you a little information.
Yeah, no, we appreciate it. It's just a little difficult right now.
Sorry about that. I'm in my office setting as opposed to my home computer.
I guess, hey, just to simplify my question a little bit, and thank you, I just wanted to see if you were in support of such a research with Dr. Harris's proposal.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, thank you. That was my question. And I appreciate the other details.
Thank you.
All right, so for our attorney to do the research, for the staff to look at aggregating these cases, we need a concise list. I know we do have some items in the record, but does anyone have the willingness, ability, note-taking skills that they're willing to take a stab at a list that the rest of us can criticize quickly?
Yeah.
Okay,
I got it.
All right, give us a list and let's see where it gets us.
Okay, for per the staff recommendation, this is related. Case number. Got to read it slowly. So
yeah. So
case number. Specialty of dentist.
Sorry, Dr. Blaise, can case number of the number of what?
I believe that represents the case number for the adverse outcome is what it references.
The board,
oh,
case,
the board
case number. Yeah.
Not,
which I don't know if that's that relevant, but they put it on there. I personally think that's very relevant. But it's on there. Permit type. Number of providers involved in the administration of anesthesia is able to be determined. And I think it's safe to say we'll expound on that further on. Age of patient. Outcome of case. Significant medical history. Was the anesthesia provider involved in the dental care or the work? The procedure performed and the duration. The type of anesthesia, the intended level of anesthesia, and the actual level. Drugs used, dosages given, time stamp, and anesthesia monitors. Personnel involved in the event, including assistants, and their level of training. The site of the treatment, such as the oral surgery office, a surgery center, a dental office, or a pediatric dental office. The site where the death or the morbidity occurred, such as during the procedure, the recovery area, or the car.
Or tertiary care facility.
Okay, or tertiary care facility. And the personnel present when EMS was activated and on the scene. And the details of the event.
I would also recommend weight of the patient.
BMI or weight? Or both?
Ideally both.
I mean, because BMI,
You may not get BNI, but especially with pediatric, weight's important, and obese is important with the adult population.
With sedation, I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm. Did you say past medical history?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Significant medication, medical history, or past medical history.
Should we better? That was where my question was. Is it standard enough of what significant medical history is, or do we need
to say past medical history?
Past medical. Okay, so then it should be.
Height, weight should be part of past medical.
It should be.
As well as past surgery. Including those documents. I would still include height and weight.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the nice thing about the statutes for every permit level indicate that should be on there. Height and weight, right? Under the current statutes. So it should be.
We're not asking for something special.
Right. Okay. The only thing I would add to monitors, well, I guess the monitors are sufficient, but just to be, I guess we'd want to be as complete as possible, you know, to just say, you know, they had a blood pressure cuff, you know, or they had a critic care. I think someone mentioned a brand name. We should look at other items. Did it have capnography? Did it have a precordial stethoscope? Did they have pulse oximetry? Those are specifics.
Can you list off, like, while there are some monitors that contain all that, it would be good for the board that's not familiar with the monitor to know, okay, I want to know, was pulse ox used, was capnography used, was EKG used, was
blood pressure.
Non-invasive blood pressure used, those types of things.
Yeah, I think so. What did you forget? That was it. OQ saturation?
This is Jeremy. To Dr. Beanstalk's point, is the board going to be able to obtain information? Are they going to be able to capture it, to Dr. Snell's point? It would just be so much easier, and Seth, this is a question for you, if we were all to sign a non-disclosure agreement in an executive session, if each committee member were assigned a number of cases, we could present to the committee, and within minutes, I think we can obtain all the information we needed from each case. It'd be much more efficient, much more accurate, and I think much more purposeful. So I don't know if under an NDA, an executive session, that could be done.
This is Brady. I actually support that idea.
Brian would support that. I mean, can the names of the, you know, for people that have been dismissed, can the names just be taken from the report?
Yeah, I think, and Seth can chime in too, I think that just the introduction of executives, we can go into an executive session to discuss confidential. And so you hold the meeting, do whatever you want to do, like the normal public agenda or whatever, and then let people leave when you decide to go into an executive session. And I don't know how many cases, it's say there's 500 cases, then just we could separate or work as teams or whatever, I don't know.
I love the idea too, except I wouldn't include all committee members because most of it's going to be German to meet Dr. Turner.
Yeah, so I was going to say maybe we should keep it to the oral surgeons, physicians,
the clinicians,
the anesthesia providers.
Yeah, the anesthesia, yeah, people that have done it and are licensed to do it. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think we're asking Seth if this is allowable. It sounds like, according to Mr. Edmondson, it is.
Or at least maybe. So can we motion that if it's allowable by who is it governed by, the Attorney General, then is that?
No, it's just advice is what we're asking.
It's just advice.
Well, he's not telling us to stop. Dr. Beanstalk, you had a comment?
I was going to say that I think we should include Dr. Harris or Dr. Dubkin or any of the consultants who've worked on some of these cases because they have great knowledge of them.
Okay. We have a list.
Before we go, this is Blake again, just to follow up on Dr. Snell's point. So I'll just recap all the monitors that we kind of use. Non-invasive blood pressure, EKG, pulse oximetry, pulse rate, capnography, precordial stethoscope, and supplemental oxygen. It's not a monitor, but again, just throwing everything at the wall.
You
think
EKG?
I did say EKG, because not everybody uses EKG or required to, but some may, but at least they have pulse rate, so those types of things.
Okay, so the concept in the motion, as I understand it, is to have the clinicians on the committee who do anesthesia under an NDA in a protected way review the cases with a list, somewhat as a way to keep a record of how what we found when the review was done, and then in that executive session meet together to go over these cases so that we know our known universe, rather than waiting 6 months or in a California case 12 years for a study. Okay, so that's a motion that I would second. Is that basically what we're getting to,
yes, Dr. Turner? Yes.
All right. So discussion on that motion in a second.
I have one
order we should discuss after a
moment. We're still asking the board staff to come with, to give you a case of adverse occurrences for sedation, right? That's up to them to provide. We're not doing that part of it.
Right.
Correct. Once we get those cases, then what you're motioning is that we review them as a committee rather than putting all that burden on the staff.
Correct. Will we have each committee member get all of them, and then we'll divide out who's reviewing which one?
I think either way, this is German. I think that to be efficient, a or a couple committee members could get together and be assigned a number of cases. They can review and present those cases to the committee for final discussion, rather than every member get every case. I just think it would be more efficient.
If it's able to have the universe available to all but the assignment to some, then that would allow, you know, for it to be done. Mr. Edmondson?
Yes, I agree. The case would come from us. I do have a follow-up question before a discussion on another motion. We do have anesthesia cases that are not adverse occurrences, that are not reported by the provider, simply because they don't know they're supposed to or what. In fact, I think we just received one of last week where there was another death case, I believe, right? And not reported. I think it happened in July. We just found out about it from the patient's family last week. So that would be an adverse occurrence that should have been reported, but so we would grab those anesthesia. You want that?
Yes, I would say.
Yes, the reportable cases,
yeah,
whether they were reported or not.
And with that, to clarify too, cases dismissed with no findings, we would want as part of this known universe. So really what we're asking for is the history that the board staff can provide.
Should be easy since none of the staff that are in this room were here for a year.
Okay, so that's the motion and the second. So all in favor of us proceeding in that manner?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Hearing none. Okay, Mr. Edmondson, timeline. Really, we are now at much of from our initial meetings, what we're all hoping to get to is, hey, we want to know what's happened and try to figure out why. So how soon is that the staff could assemble such information for dissemination?
So it's super hard to give an estimate. And without airing some of their laundry, we have quite a bit of issues that we're having to tackle that are old cases. That the board will have to review. We're short-staffed already, and I'm not trying to create an excuse. I'm simply giving a perspective from without airing too much. But I don't know, Lisa, Sherry, help me out.
I think all cases from 2016 prior are archived, so we have to get those out of archives.
How far back were we wanting them to go?
Yeah, that's the...
We originally started with 2010, but I don't know what you guys want now.
In 2010, I don't think there's a different quote.
I don't believe there's a lot of legal. This is Sherry Board staff. From 2010, our database transitioned over in 2010 to what we currently have, and the system that we have, which is AO, that we use now for adverse occurrence, I was only able to find that to 2012. Prior to that, I don't know how we would be able to gather that historical.
Yeah. So we can do our best. We'll cover 2012 for present, and we'll go back to 2010, because I think the original request was 10, and then there was some discussion about the possibility of only going to 12. We'll do what we can to do both, and we probably won't have it tomorrow.
This is Dr. Harris. I'm back again. May I make a comment?
Please.
The anesthesia committee met and did the rules change in 2013. That was 7 years ago, which is a longer period than either the Texas or the California study did. And I will tell you that there basically half of the fatalities that occurred in the state of Arizona in the last 12 and a half years have happened since that 2013. So 2013 and forward might be a useful date, just because that's when the last rules committee met.
Yeah, and that does make some logical sense in that we're trying to review the rules as they exist and what they should become, not what they were before the last version. So.
Correct, because 1304 permits didn't exist prior to 2013. So I might encourage you to choose your study parameters to be from 2013 on.
And seeing in the room a lot of nodding heads, that looks to be the right direction. Thank you for that insight. Okay, so staff, that's only 3 to 4 years of archives, depending on when in 16 it was archived. So. And Ryan, or Mr. Edmondson, you said you can't have it tomorrow. Does that mean a month, a week, 6 months? I mean, what's realistic?
I would say you guys probably won't be in December. take off from that unless you get determined later in the meeting. So you might be able, I would say we probably have at least the file to you by January, if you met in January. Okay. There's a board meeting in January. So normally the board meets early in the month, but because of the holidays around the first, they meet at the end of January and then no February. So you guys could be before February.
Well, I think it could be very beneficial if we have a meeting of this nature where we come up with some understanding from the meeting with the board. Now you've got Martin Luther King Day, you've got New Year's, you've got a lot of holidays between here and there, but if the committee is okay with that as an idea, basically it'd be staff needs to get us the information get the information together by the end of the year.
Mr. Goodman and Mr. Edmondson, if it pleases everybody here, I kind of wrote up what everyone was talking about as
sure.
A motion, as a formal motion. So I would move that during an executive session, a committee including the clinicians on the anesthesia sedation committee, as well as the possibility of adding a couple other pertinent clinician members, convene to review the requested data related to the adverse anesthetic occurrences reported and not reported to BODEX, if allowable, per the district attorney.
Okay,
I'm sorry, is this the attorney general?
Would you like to use the term board consultants instead of people pertinent?
Sure, we can do that. I can add that. Sedation committee as well as pertinent board consultants.
Okay.
Yeah. My belief that's what we already voted on and agreed to, but that makes it very concise for the group, for the staff. So I think we're good on that end.
Just looking at the staff here.
Yeah, now it makes it concise. Thank you. All right. So from there, we've hit much of the meat of today in the discussion. What's the wish of the committee as far as proceeding on today's meeting? Want to get into the other points, or?
I believe we adjourn.
Well, that's what that was what I'm wondering.
I'm motion.
Okay. The consensus is, the feeling is that we've accomplished what we can today, and I know in past meetings it's been figured out by the staff on when we can meet. In concept, if we can have that as a goal to be in January prior to the dental board's meeting, that would be best. So if we can allow the staff to plan that meeting and do it through the same, venue or same surveying they've done in the past.
Okay.
All right. So hearing a motion, a second, all in favor. Oh, please, Mr. Edmondson.
Just because you guys have minutes on here, I don't recall anybody.
Thank you. Yeah,
it would be helpful because I'm supposed to.
Yeah.
In German, almost just.
No. We've got to first get the minutes approved. Is what we have. So, looking for some minutes. Okay. All right. Wait, Wes, go ahead.
Could you please state your name?
Oh, sorry. I was going to motion to approve the minutes from last meeting. German, second.
All right,
gotcha. My only point is, Blazik, my point on the minutes would be, I do not think you've accurately captured Dr. Duncan's report. I would have him, I believe that he specifically talked about a level playing field between dental anesthesiologists, CRNAs, and medical anesthesiologists. As far as specific of what he discussed, that's the only thing I thought about the minutes that just was a little cursory. Is that a good word, I think?
So the minutes are literally like a clip note version of what took place. The audio is also available.
So we can approve this and
As long as it's not, I think what we look for is to make sure it's not in conflict. Because they don't type it up all.
I see.
All right, so we have and thank you for the discussion. So we have a motion and a second to approve the minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Edmondson, for helping us not run out of the building before we got that done. Is there anything else we are missing?
I don't think so. There's other stuff on your agenda.
No, of course. Yeah. Yeah, I think the committee feels like we've gotten the work that we need done today and made all the assignments that we need to for staff. So thank you, everybody, and we adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, man.